This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Here's a question. Would you eat a burger made by a robot? A robotics startup in San Francisco is betting that you will. Momentum Machines has designed a contraption they think is going to revolutionize the fast food industry. A robot that can create a made-to-order burger in less time than it takes a human and at a fraction of the cost. The aim isn't to make line cooks more efficient, it's to eliminate them altogether. Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at Zero Coal and Word of Mouth's Chief Explainer of All Things Wired. He thinks this is the next great frontier in automation and robotics, but the question remains, will people be willing to try a machine-made burger? And Rob, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
So people have been talking about a hamburger robot for a couple of years.
That's right.
How does this one work?
Well, Momentum Machines is really about scale. I mean, you have to think about automation today. And we're okay in our heads today with a lot of robots and a lot of automation. For example, our whole automobile manufacturing process, right? We're all perfectly aware that there are hundreds of robots that build our cars.
Sure.
They weld everything. They paint everything. And we're fine with that, you know? And by the way, they do a much better job than we do. They're very accurate. They're consistent. They use less materials. Obviously, you don't want to expose human beings to painting anymore. I mean, that's dangerous chemicals. And, you know, it's just hard for humans to do that and do it right and do it over and over and over again. So our whole automobile process of manufacturing has been taken over by automation and robots. But that's large scale, right? That's large jobs, big volume,
yeah,
big cost, million-dollar robots, et cetera. And what the Momentum Machine guys are doing is they're really bringing that down to a smaller scale, to a restaurant scale, to a McDonald's, a Burger King, a Wendy's, a KFC-type scale, where you're talking about eliminating four or five jobs, not hundreds of jobs.
Right, right.
But they're applying the same technology. They want things to be safer. You know, they want things to be consistent. They want it to be cleaner.
Okay, well, hold on. You're getting to the argument of why this is better. But what's the thing actually look like? We're talking about one machine that apparently does every part of the process from, you know, shaping the burger to sticking it in a package and putting it in front of a consumer.
Well, you know, it's very conveyor-like. And it's actually not any different than what you've seen. If you watch the Discovery Channel, they have a great show called How It's Made.
Oh, I love that show.
Oh, it's a great show. And they show you how rubber gloves are made and how Doritos and chips and pancakes and paper towels and you name it, frozen foods are made. And you look at those things and, even things like ice cream, right? If you drive up to Ben & Jerry's up in Vermont, you'll see their assembly line, their manufacturing process. It's very similar to what Momentum Machines is doing. Conveyors, machines that do pressing and padding and assembly, less robot painting, you know, much less like a robotic arm with a paint gun or a welding gun.
Right.
Much more like things that stamp and conveyors that move. For example, pizzas moving under, through an oven, things like that. That's much more like what their machines are made like. And really what they're doing is they're building a manufacturing plant in the back of a small fast food restaurant.
So you mentioned some of the upsides that you see in this sort of automated retail fast food market. Cheaper, you said cleaner.
You bet.
What else?
Consistency is a big deal, right? All these restaurants want things to be the same everywhere, right? You eat a Big Mac in China, you want it to be the same as here in Concord, New Hampshire.
Right.
So consistency is huge, not just cheaper from a labor point of view, but also food waste. I mean, obviously, machines aren't emotional. They don't wake up after the Patriots win the Super Bowl and have a tough day at work, right? They're going to work consistently and efficiently no matter what.
Right.
And so that's a big factor, too. Safety is also a big factor. You know, I mean, although they've done a great job in a lot of these restaurants, you know, there's still heat involved. There's still danger involved. There's still cutting involved. So there's going to be a lot less injuries and things like that. And, you know, sadly eliminates jobs. And I believe we have a bit more of a problem with this innovation than we have in the past.
In terms of it eliminating jobs because of the type of jobs that we're thinking about, you know, this entry level, you know, this is like classic high school workers, you know, first opportunity to get a job and pay some bills while they're still in high school.
Right. I mean, how do you feel about that, right? You go to a busy fast food restaurant and there might be 8 or 9 or 10 people working at any particular time of day. Obviously, you know, certain shifts are going to be less and certain are going to be more. But how do you feel if that goes down to 2 or 3 people, you know, where a guy in the back is more of a mechanic or more of a janitor? Maybe he's cleaning up and restocking things for the robots. And at night, maybe some higher skilled people come in to do some maintenance and some deep cleaning and that sort of stuff. But most of the day, maybe it's, you know, some touch screens out front, 1 or 2 people there handing you stuff, and maybe 1 person in the back. You know, that's what I see as staffing these restaurants in the next 3 years.
So touchscreens in front and robots in the back. That's Rob Fleischman's view of the future for fast food places like McDonald's and Burger King. And we're talking about what he believes is the next great frontier in automation and robotics. And, you know, you're talking about staffing. You've already jumped to the idea that this is going to sell.
I'm completely convinced.
I know you're sold, but I'm still a little skeptical. So how do you think, you know, a McDonald's or a Burger King is going to sell this idea if they decided to go for it? Because I think it's hard to imagine a marketing campaign that introduces consumers to this idea that robots are going to make all their food in restaurants they've been going to maybe for years.
You are right. It's going to be a tough sell. But let me give you some scenarios. Okay, so let's take it personal. Let's walk down the road to Merrimack, New Hampshire. There's a big Budweiser plant there, right? And you should know that there are certain times of day when there are more people working on the Clydesdales that live there than there are on the beer that's being produced there. That's a good old American something that we consume all the time. And, you know, it's got barley and hops. But the reality is most of the people at the Budweiser plant are behind a glassed-in room staring at computer terminals and while the beer is being cranked out. So why are we okay with that? Well, it's kind of behind closed doors, right? I mean, you know, the trucks show up and the beer shows up and we watch the marketing and it's wonderful, right?
Sure, yeah.
So I claim that method is what's going to happen. When Ford and GM and everyone went to more robots, they didn't roll the robots in and fire everybody. What they did was they built a new plant, or more accurately, they closed a plant and then upgraded it and then opened the doors and said, hey, we need 100 employees, not 1,000. And here are the specs on what we need. Here are the job offers. Here are the resumes that we need for these jobs. So I claim that what's probably going to happen is, and you know, as you know, these guys are opening restaurants all the time. I claim that there's going to be some new McDonald's or maybe some new Burger Kings. I'm not sure what fast food chain or convenience food company will be first, but someone's going to. Maybe there's an upside. Maybe you walk in and there's a touch screen there and you can customize every little thing about the burger, right? Mm-hmm. Something that would be hard to do with humans because, you know, they'll screw the order up and every single thing is going to be different. What a pain in the neck, right? It's easier to make 100 Big Macs do the same. But the computers don't care, right? You go up, you hit your touch screen, you type every little thing you want, you hit build, shows up exactly like you want. Right? Okay. That might be an interesting gimmick. And maybe there's a few trial stores. Maybe it's successful. And boy, you can talk resistance and marketing till the cows come home. But let me tell you, when you're squeezing profit out of those companies, and the scale is huge, right? I mean, if you triple the profit at one of those restaurants and you have 100,000 of them, that goes right to the bottom line.
And you can afford to maybe lose a few customers who aren't okay with the process.
They'll come back.
Yeah.
And by the way, the ones who probably feel, you know, in their hearts deeply about how the burger's made, they might not be going to McDonald's anyway.
Well, it's funny that you would say that because, you know, as I talk about this, and I get excited about any sort of futurism type stuff, you know, I think a lot about where food is today in the public psyche, and I'm thinking about Shake Shack, an alternative sort of burger joint that just went public.
Yeah, they just
public.
Went public. I mean,
yeah. Five Guys showing up in strip malls. You know, these are all about actually sort of making things that are a little more handcrafted than the McDonald's that we're used to.
Well, that's actually what the fast food chains are worried about. You know, McDonald's isn't losing money to Burger King, right? I mean, they've been in business competing against each other forever.
Right.
What they're losing money to is exactly that, the more premium burgers. It's not, hey, you're not going to Five Guys and getting a big burger there for $2 like you do at McDonald's or less, right? You're spending $5, $6, maybe more. You know, the person who wants to feed their family for a low price isn't going to Five Guys. So that's why that claim, I think, is why this actually has a better chance of success. Because McDonald's looks at it and goes, well, look, people are coming to us for that low price quality product. And if we can make the price lower or more consistent or better, hey, let's do that. But the other thing to think about here, I just find it funny that there's sort of, even in myself, a resistance to this idea. That,
yeah.
You know, hey, that was my high school job. Hey, you know, I worked at McDonald's when I was a high school kid, too. And, you know, there's a resistance to get rid of those jobs. But yet in other areas, you know, and let me give you another area. We have no resistance. Like right now, you can go to Concord Hospital and get robotic-assisted surgery. There's mm-hmm. a lot of laparoscopic surgery that, you know, the surgeons are using robots or joysticks, et cetera. You know, how do you feel? How would you feel, Taylor, if, you know, you were getting a knee replacement and the doctor actually wasn't in the surgery room? What if he was on the other side of glass?
Oh, I'm okay with that. You know? But I have to say that I feel that it's so different because of the food aspect, which is that food holds this almost this like mythos to us, because there's this traditional sense that, you know, the way things used to be, the way things always were supposed to be, was this farm to table environment. And we looked at McDonald's and we looked at what they did with an assembly line, and we decided we can accept this compromise.
Mm.
But the moment that you even take people's hands out of it, even if we know that those hands are more prone to error than that of a robot, that for some reason people see it as this cold and sterile thing. And food is supposed to be a warm and alive product, and it makes it different than...
Do you think it's that we're being fed by the machines? Do you think it makes us feel more like cats and dogs? Like, well, we all line up and the machines feed us,
well,
and life goes on.
It's very Aldous Huxley.
Little dystopian reality, little Terminator fear there coming
yeah.
down the line.
Oh, well, either which way, I think it's time to get to prediction time, because I know you love this sort of stuff. So how long before you think that we're going to be seeing burgers made by robots in New Hampshire?
I think it's 3 years. I think 3 years we're going to see prototype restaurants with this type of technology. I think that the economics are too compelling. There's too many reasons to do it.
Well, Rob, we will be calling you back in 3 years.
And you know what, Taylor? Why don't we agree to enjoy lunch with each other from a robot-built burger?
Okay, it's on. It's on.
I'll treat.
Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at ZeroCol and Word of Mouth's Chief Explainer of All Things Wired. And you can find more on the Robo Burger Machine that got us talking about this in the first place at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from robots in the food industry to robots in a little more pastoral setting. When you think of 4-H, state fairs and blue ribbon livestock competitions probably come to mind. And while the program does have an agricultural focus, it's not afraid of the future. A few years ago at the Iowa State Fair, 4-H changed things up with a robotics challenge, and Kathleen Masterson brings us the story.
To go up the ramp or use an arm to drop it.
The toxic teens from St. Augustine School in Des Moines are debating just how to build their robot. It's just moments after the 8 youth teams have received their challenge. The task? Get the robot to transport a tiny beanbag up a cornhole ramp and then deposit it into one of 3 holes, with the top one worth the most points.
I'm building the NXT robot, since it needs to have like a little support system so it can have the stuff it's using, like the wheels and all the motors and sensors.
Peter Kappert of the Toxic Teens is working with his sister Claire to build the moving components they'll attach to the small robot body, which is about the size of a Walkman. Then they program it using software on their laptop. This is the second year of the Brattney 4-H Robotics Challenge at the State Fair. The number of teams has more than doubled, and this year they had to turn some teams away. Holly Bignall works in Iowa State University Extension's Science, Engineering, and Technology Division and runs the competition.
Well, this is definitely a really quickly growing segment of 4-H, is this robotics specifically, but also just science, engineering, technology in general. It's something that really appeals to urban youth, and we're definitely trying to reach more urban youth.
Bignall says a big part of the goal is to increase the number of youth interested in science, engineering, and technology.
The robotics is really a team activity, and there's lots of different roles for different people. So we really try and encourage the adults that work with the kids not to present it as just something that the kids who are into computer programming will want to do, because that's not the case at all. I mean, some kids are really more into the sort of figuring out the mechanisms and the gear ratios and all those types of things.
And that teamwork, vision, and creativity really kicks into play in the other half of the robotics competition, the junk drawer challenge.
We have like a ruler, a propeller, a couple colored pencils, some sort of weird necklace thing, a couple straws.
Basically everything that we have will help us finish it.
That's the atomic fireballs from Dallas County pouring over the odds and ends they have to build their machine. It has to set off 4 mouse traps, each glued to the corner of a poster-sized board. There's a whole range of elaborate constructions. Some teams are building windmill-like blades out of cardboard or taped-together pencils. Then they're attaching them to a small motor so they'll whip around and pop the mousetraps. Over at another table, the Lego medics are devising a giant tube to set off a chain reaction of marbles down chutes.
So, one marble is going to come down one chute and hit the mousetrap. And if we're lucky, we might be able to get in and set off another mousetrap in sequence.
And after the 3 hours are up, the teams bring their creations to the stage and put them to the test. Two teams at a time face off, and they have 90 seconds to get their robot or machine to run the task.
3, 2, 1, Lego!
Their teammates groan and cheer from the audience as beanbags slide into place, or sometimes land frustratingly close to the hole without sliding in. In the end, the grand prize goes to the exuberant Lego medics. The toxic teens win the junk drawer challenge, and the STEMgineers win the robot programming contest. Jay Staker of Iowa State University Extension Science, Engineering, and Technology says they're really trying to grow their focus on science.
I think it's our future. Most of our youth now live in urban counties. And with that, we have to have great opportunities for these kids to see themselves in 4-H.
I'm Kathleen Masterson, Harvest Public Media.
And Word of Mouth returns with the latest installment in our series on offbeat college courses, The Uncommon Core. When we return, American Vacations 101.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. The Uncommon Core is a series that examines unusual college courses being taught in schools across the country. In this episode, we discover a class that lends a very serious approach to the history of leisure. In fact, studying how Americans relax can teach us a lot about the history of privilege and social class in the United States.
Hi, my name is Susan Burrell. I teach in the American Studies and Women's Studies programs at the University of Iowa, and I teach a course on the American vacation. Vacations were an important part of the social life of the upper class in the United States throughout the 19th century. They even had a circuit of vacations that followed the sun in some ways. And it's not until the turn of the 20th century that the middle class begins to see vacations as something that's possible for them.
The presidential yacht Williamsburg stands by in the Potomac to take aboard the chief executive for his first extended vacation since taking over the job 16 months ago.
One of the issues, one of the things that had to get resolved was how to justify, what rationales to use for this newly emerging, hard-working middle class to make it seem logical for them to take time away from work, which was seen as the centerpiece of their lives.
The last Civil War veteran would die in 1959, and no longer would there be living memories of long-ago battles, only history and legends.
Historic tourism, for example, going to visit the battlefields of the Civil War, going to a historic site was thought of as a worthy use of leisure time. Or later on, when the national parks became available, going out west celebrated the wild beauty of the United States and consolidated notions of our pride in the U.S.
Every summer, thousands of pleasure-seeking tourists head for the great outdoor playgrounds of America.
Every day, it's the same old thing. Look at the bears, look at the bears, look at the bears.
Sheesh. But probably the biggest rationale was the notion that the vacation was something that families would do together. Particularly white middle-class families found the vacation a really central part of family life.
Are we there yet?
No!
Are we there yet?
No!
Are we there yet?
No!
We talk about the cottages of Newport, Rhode Island. We talk about the growth of the Adirondacks as a place where rusticators could have their vacations. We work our way through the 20th century, usually ending in Disneyland, which is the most common experience for everybody in the class. At the end of the semester, they've done 3 interviews with themselves, their parents, their grandparents, and they write a vacation history, which is a joy for me to read.
Well, I'll tell you something. This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun.
Inevitably, what happens at the end of the semester is that students have learned what a privilege it is to be part of a rich vacation history. It's likely that their grandparents might say, "We never took a vacation when I was a kid." But in fact, what they find then is that, well, they went to the state fair every year.
Our state fair is a great state fair. Don't miss it. Don't even be late.
One of the experiences that I can draw on is my own family experience of vacations. And we took a number of family vacations to historic sites. And the grand finale was the trip that we took out west to see the national parks. Of course, we took it in a car, with all that entailed in the years before superhighways.
Well, if you ever plan to motor west.
So now when I look back on that trip, I can see it as a piece of history. I can see what inspired the trip for my family. I can see the experiences in a new light. And I'm hoping that that's the way that students look at their own vacations.
Well, it winds from Chicago to L.A.
The Uncommon Core is produced by me, Taylor Quimby, and you can hear a new episode every Thursday here on Word of Mouth. And learn more about the series and listen to other episodes at wordofmouthradio.org. If you're a movie buff, you probably know actor John C. Reilly as That Guy. He's been praised for his many, many versatile roles from films like Chicago, Boogie Nights, Step Brothers. But when we return, I'll chat with Reilly about his latest role as the leader of a country folk band. First, this news.
Jack and take that California trip. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Word of mouth.
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 Now, darling, I've tried. I've never done wrong.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. From Boogie Nights to Chicago to Wreck-It Ralph, character actor John C. Reilly is known for his diverse acting chops. More recently, though, he's been taking to performing folk music and country standards with his band, John Reilly and Friends.
I'm for you. We're so far apart. It's never too late. Start over new.
This is a recording that comes from an NPR Tiny Desk concert that Reilly played earlier this week, and you can hear John Reilly and Friends perform tomorrow at the Somerville Armory in Somerville, Mass. John C. Reilly, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Dill. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So it's always a funny experience when you see an actor have a side project involving music, because you can't help but wonder, is this the real you?
Well, I've lost track of the real me for a long time now. I think that's sort of the actor's life. You know, you're a vessel for all these different things, characters, and now music. So, I suppose when I write my memoirs or something, I might try to figure out who the real me is. But until then, it's just a series of roles that I play.
Have you always been interested in this type of music specifically?
Yes and no. I got into playing this music with this group about 5 years ago. But, yeah, I grew up listening to old Irish traditional music from my father, and I was always drawn to this kind of music. I just didn't really heavily dive into it until I would probably say in college at some point when I started to play the guitar is when I started to really get into it. And the Stanley Brothers, that song that you just played a clip from, they were one of my first sort of touchstones into bluegrass music.
Now, it doesn't really seem fair, but for some reason, I've always found it a little strange when you hear about famous actors deciding to do music. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it seems like a real stretch, but it really does seem to work for you, and I wonder if partly that's because you've somehow sort of managed to avoid getting typecast all these years. How have you managed to do that, by the way?
Well, I wish I could say it was all me. I mean, the fact is, actors and performers in general are allowed to do what the audience is willing to let them do, you know. You can make choices and you can take risks and stuff like that as a performer, but if the audience doesn't back you up and say, yeah, we're into that, then it can be a pretty short-lived experiment. But in terms of, like, why this music thing is working. I think part of it is that it's not just me with some sort of hired band behind me telling you my innermost thoughts on my new album. It's really a collective of people and everything. It's very much a democracy, so I think that kind of sheds a lot of the baggage of the famous actor trotting out a band kind of thing. But these are old traditional songs, a lot of them very, very old, some of them before the written music era, let alone the recorded music era. So our shows end up feeling like these sort of community events and these kind of, I don't know, I don't want to get too...
See too much into it?
I just don't want to get too precious about it, but a lot of people say after our shows, like, wow, that was so moving, like, I knew that song, but I didn't know that I knew it, and my soul feels nourished, and like all these crazy things people say. But to be fair, like, I think to limit people according to their chosen profession is a mistake on everyone's part, including the people themselves. Like, if you have a poem in you and you're a broadcaster, you should write that poem. You know, if you're someone who works at the post office but you have a brilliant recipe idea in your head, you should cook that food. And if you're an actor who can sing, why not sing? You know, like, I don't think we should limit ourselves, especially in terms of artistic pursuits, because the world needs more of it.
I'm totally with you. Actually, as you say this, I'm starting to feel bad because it seems so much that the audience puts an expectation on a performer that, you know, I mean, who knows? Like, maybe Tom Cruise is a deep, deep soul, but we're so used to seeing him play, you know, Mission Impossible that's what we expect.
Yeah, I think the world is a richer place when we encourage artistic expression in everybody, not just in very well-known public figures, but in our everyday life.
Well, let's listen to another song from your group. This is John Riley and Friends, and this is from a project called the Black Cab Sessions. Do you want to explain a little bit, actually, how this recording was made before I play a clip?
Well, the Black Cab Sessions is this great thing that they do in, well, it started in England. They've done some in the U.S. now, too. But basically, when a band comes to town that they like, they ask them to come and get in the back of an English black cab, which are these big, gorgeous black cars that are all over London.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And you sit in the back. Luckily, they have very big back seats. And you sit in the back and you play music while they drive around London. And they film it. Tom and Becky and I did a black cab session while we were in London doing a concert there. And pretty happy with how it turned out. It's an old song called Sweet Rosie Anne.
Let's hear a little bit.
Sweet Rosie Anne, sweet Rosie Anne, bye-bye, sweet Rosianna. I thought I heard my baby say, I won't be home tomorrow. Sweet Rosie Anne, my darling child, bye-bye, sweet Rosianna. Sweet Rosie Anne, my darling child, I won't be home tomorrow.
Bye bye, bye bye, bye bye, bye bye, bye bye, sweet Rosie.
My guest is the entertainer John C. Reilly, known mostly for his many roles in film and TV, and more recently for the beautiful renditions of folk and country classics that he plays with his band, John Riley and Friends. Now, I really love this recording. You know, you hear a little bit of the engine sound, gives it some character.
Yeah, you can hear the car bouncing around a little bit.
But it's actually, like, surprisingly clean. Like, it makes me really impressed with the soundproofing of a black cab in London.
Yeah. It's also, I mean, I encourage everyone to check out blackcabsessions.com because there are all kinds of amazing musicians, some of your favorites you'll see doing this, and the cityscape that's going by is this kind of dreamy thing that happens. It's really kind of a magical formula, cabs and music.
So, you know, you mentioned them already. You're playing with some really amazing performers, your group. Now, do you ever feel bad sort of calling yourself John C. Reilly and Friends? I mean, why not Becky Stark and, you know, that guy from Boogie Nights and Talladega Nights and all those other movies?
Well, we're called John Riley and Friends. I dropped the C for the music thing because I was legally allowed to, unlike the Screen Actors Guild. But the band's called John Riley and Friends. featuring Becky Stark and Tom Brosseau, because that's kind of what it was when we started doing it in this club called Largo in Los Angeles. It was anybody's guess who was going to be there with me. I was going to be there for sure.
Right, right.
And it was anybody's guess who I could convince to come along. And also, I mean, let's be practical, like, for good or bad, my name is known to a certain number of people, and I think of it as just sort of like the chum on the back of the fishing boat. Like, it's what brings people to the shows. And then when they get there, they realize, like, oh, well, John Reilly's not even the half of it. He's not even the third of it. Like, Becky Stark and Tom Brosseau and Sebastian Steinberg and Dan Byrne and all these amazing people that we've had joined along with us are the real sort of secret weapons of the show.
Well, at this point, do you ever meet anybody who knows you from your music but has never seen any of your films or doesn't recognize you as an actor?
Actually, Bob Boylan from the Tiny Desk series said he's like, I've never seen you in a movie. I don't know anything about you except you as a musician, and I loved your show so much. So he must be a pretty sheltered guy. Committed radio guy.
He must have felt pretty silly when he went back to the office and he said, hey, I just heard this guy named John Reilly. I don't know if anybody knows him.
I actually love it. I really love it in daily life when people have no idea, because it just eliminates the whole kind of repetitive, somewhat boring conversation that I have a lot.
Yeah.
You're that guy. You're that actor. You know, you're the same questions over and over. But so I really like it when I can have that anonymity back for a second and just have a genuine one-to-one human interaction with people without the baggage that goes along with being a well-known actor.
Well, I want to switch gears for a second and play a song from one of your movies. This is from Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, which was sort of a, well, I guess it was a musical, so let's hear a little bit.
I've been scorned and slandered and ridiculed too. Had to struggle every day my whole life through. Seen my share of the worst that this world can give. But I still got a dream and a burning rage to live. Walk hard, hard, when they say you're all done. Walk bold, hard.
So I've got to ask, where does parody and a lot of the musical comedy, I mean, you've done a lot of bits for Funny or Die, for example, how does that fit in with what you're doing now? You know, is it totally different, or does it scratch some sort of musical itch for you as well?
Well, despite the fact that Walk Hard was a satire, the music part of it, we tried really hard to do very well. You know, we're very sincere in our efforts to make the music good, so hopefully that comes through. I mean, I think we wrote something like almost 40 original songs in 6 months or something for that movie with this group of songwriters and musicians. But, yeah, I mean, the shows that we have with John Reilly and friends are often very funny. There's a lot of laughter there because we talk to the audience and we just kind of, like, check in with them in the moment, and I think people find it kind of bracing that we're so in the moment and just talking about what's really happening. So there's a lot of humor in it, but there is a sincerity to the music that we take pretty seriously. You know, we don't do satirical songs or songs from Walk Hard or whatever. We do old traditional folk and bluegrass and country music, and our kind of criteria for the music we choose to do is stuff that has an eternal quality. Not just a spiritually eternal quality, but just a musically eternal quality, like something about these songs. Like, you hear them one time and they stick with you. And I think all of us in the band are kind of fascinated by what makes a song survive, what makes a song get passed on from generation to generation over hundreds of years.
Yeah. Well, I guess the question that I'm asking is that, you know, you're obviously a really musically talented guy. And at the same time, you're an actor. And I always wonder, you know, with somebody who has multiple talents like you, if you're trying to, you know, if you're searching for roles where you're going to get to, you know, wander a little bit. Chicago is another good example where you had a different voice that you got to exercise. And if that's something that you as a, you know, as a performer are looking to do to expand your repertoire.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to do everything I can do while I'm alive, you know. trying to express myself in any way that I can. And, you know, I think it's actually kind of funny these days how surprised people are that actors can sing or dance or do things other than acting, because not too long ago, like, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago, it was expected of actors that you sing, dance, you know, like...
Sure, the vaudeville tradition sort of thing.
Yeah, you were supposed to be like the full package. You're an entertainer. That's what you were supposed to do. So I guess I'm a throwback in that way.
Well, let's hear another tune from your Tiny Desk concert earlier this week. This one is Rock of Ages.
I was standing by the bedside where my fevered mother lay when she called me close beside her, and these words I heard her say: I have seen the Rock of Ages, Jacob's ladder hang down.
You've made a few recordings with John Reilly and friends on vinyl. Do you have any plans to do a full-length album or expand on what you've got thus far, or is that pretty difficult with your schedule?
You know, the thing about it, the reason we haven't done it so far, I think, is that there's a really special quality that comes across in the shows with the audience there, and when we're alone, I don't know, there's some important element missing. So anyway, it took us a while to figure out that we need to do a live recording, and we're working on that. We're starting to record a lot of the shows that we do, and we'll probably distill it down into something soon. And yeah.
Well, John Reilly, when you do, I hope we can have you back on the show, and we'll talk again about it more.
I'd love to, Taylor. Thanks for all your kind words about the music. I appreciate it.
Of course. John C. Reilly, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You can see John Reilly and friends perform tomorrow night at the Somerville Armory in Somerville, Mass. There's more information at wordofmouthradio.org.
Should repeat that again.
Feel, 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 feel. Feel my heat.
Feel my heat. Yeah, it's definitely cool.
Coming up, more proof that good music comes from unexpected places. A diehard blues man from Budapest, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Just a few minutes ago, actor and musician John C. Reilly reminded us not to pigeonhole entertainers into one genre or another. And our next story is just more proof that great art comes from unexpected places. Tanner Latham of the podcast Authentic South brings us this story of a dedicated blues man who was born far, far away from the Memphis sound he's come to love.
Little G. Weevil has a signature hat. It's an ivy cap, one of those vintage flat hats that Samuel L. Jackson likes to wear. And he's got the word Sunnyland tattooed on his right forearm. It's a reference to Sunnyland Slim, a blues pianist from the Mississippi Delta who was big in Chicago in the 1940s and 50s.
Well, tell me, baby, which way should I go? Which way should I go? You keep me out the door.
But Sunnyland is also the middle name Little G gave his first son. He gave his second son the middle names John Lee.
So I was 16 years old when I heard this gentleman, John Lee Hooker. He was the first bluesman I heard. And that kind of changed my whole life, obviously, because I just wanted to be a bluesman. From that on, I knew what I was meant to do.
The blues have been his life for the last 20 years. My name is Tanner Latham, and this is Authentic South. When I first heard Little G. Weevil sing the blues, I thought his voice was very Louisiana, like it was filtered through the bayou.
Well, you know, woke up this morning, Jesus on my mind, Jesus on my mind, Jesus on my mind.
But he's not from the bayou at all. He's from Budapest.
Mm-hmm.
Little G's real name is Gábor Szücs. He grew up in Hungary. Now he lives in Kennesaw, Georgia, a little town engulfed by the sprawl of Metro Atlanta.
Down, 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 down.
If your dream is to be a big-time actor, you know you've got to suck it up and go to L.A., go to New York, and just start auditioning. If your dream is to be a blues man, you go to Memphis. You go to Beale Street. So Little G was in Hungary, playing the blues with some bands over there, and he decided he was ready to go try to make it happen in Memphis. He got a foreign work placement agency to find him a job in the States. It was at a hotel in Birmingham, and when he got there, he started washing dishes for them. 8 months later, Little G finally took his first trip to Memphis. He was competing in the International Blues Challenge. Now, this is a competition of over 200 different acts from all over the world. And he was immediately smitten by the city.
And I was like, man, there's no way. It was something else to me. There was a comeback, and from that on, I could not think about nothing else. And I went back, you know, work, stuff like that. I didn't care about nothing that on. I just wanted to make a move to Memphis. So
several months later, he did. He bought a van and he drove there. No job, very little money. He was just going to try to make it work. When he arrived, he parked his van on the banks of the Mississippi River.
That's why I slept in my van for 3 days and washed off, seriously, washed off in the river and stuff like that. I didn't know nobody, you know, so that's...
I mean, it's like you're living the life of a blues song.
Dude.
If you're washing your clothes in the Mississippi River...
And if you know, man, I'm telling you, that's so true. So freaking true.
He finally landed a job, again washing dishes, at a club called the Blue City Cafe on Beale Street. It was hard, 11-hour shifts, but he was there, right in the middle of the blues, and during every one of his smoke breaks, he'd walk out and watch the musicians performing on stage. One night, this guy named Earl the Pearl was playing and saw Little G standing there.
And so he was like, man, you like the blues? He's like, yeah, I do. Cool, man, you play? I play some, yeah. He was kind enough to, I had my apron on, and I go on stage. He had his guitar player, so he would send his guitar player off, and I take his guitar player's instrument and just play a song with my apron on, and the crowd is loving it, you know.
The manager ended up giving him a regular gig, and that's how Little G started playing on Beale Street. He enjoyed lots of success. He was in a band, playing multiple gigs a week. Then, life happened. The drummer in the band had a heart attack during a show and died on stage. The band dissolved. Work dried up. Little G returned to Hungary and recorded an album. He later came back to the U.S. to tour, met his future wife, and they eventually moved to Kennesaw because her family was there.
Going down in the river, sneak up to Memphis Queen.
These days, Little G is still playing the blues full time. In 2012, his album, The Teaser, was named one of the top 10 albums of the year by Mojo Magazine. He has a steady rotation of gigs in the Atlanta area, dive bars and restaurants, and the occasional full-fledged blues club or juke joint. Sometimes he travels to play. But he really misses Memphis.
It's hard, man, because now I have a family. So, and my wife knows very well how much I miss Memphis. Miss Memphis musically, but I would not raise my child in Memphis. You know, so it's kind of, you're torn between the music and your family. So you have to sacrifice. Pretty much that's it.
Remember the International Blues Challenge in Memphis? That's when Little G first stepped foot on Beale Street. Well, this past February, he returned for the competition. And this time, he was crowned the champion. He won the whole thing.
It's not bad for a Hungarian, you know?
Nice.
she only called me names. I would have never mind if I died.
That story about musician Little G. Weevil was produced by Tanner Latham, host of the podcast Authentic South. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's always more at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget to follow us or send us your feedback on Facebook and Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on NHBR.